One Jobber might be quoting 38:42, and another one might be quoting 41:45. So although there is a fourpenny spread, there is actually a penny kneeling price. And it also, it didn't prevent the broker from saying, well, I want a deal inside, I'll give you a penny less, or give me a penny more and I'll sell them to you. And also, there was, I think, perhaps some, the odd jobber who might bend his quote if he saw he wasn't getting the business on his price, and sort of say, well, I might be able to change the price, you see, 38.42. Well, would it help if I made you 39.43 if you thought the chap was a seller? So he'd be cutting a fourpenny price. That would obviously be slightly bending the rules. I think the other point that was of enormous assistance to the jobbing system at a time when it was certainly the turnover and its profitability was difficult was decimalisation. I don't know whether that's been mentioned before, but see what if you were making in the old days, let's say, a penny price, well, we'd say a tuppenny price because it would be more normal, in old money. So you were making a fivepenny price if you were making in the new pence, so that you would have already got much wider quote anyway. And I think both the public and brokers and the public were rather prepared to accept this. On your other one of the quotes of a limited width, there's also that in some cases that one didn't deal in quarters. In other words, if you made price of 4.5, you didn't make 4.25, 5.25. You could make 4.5 or 3.5, 4.5 or 4.5, 5.5. So that did slightly do it. And the other restrictive practice, which again I think it came because brokers began to screw the jobbers mercifully at times in put-throughs of the big business. If it was an absolutely straight put-through, they handed on a plate, one was prepared to accept a very small turn for your services. After all, you were taking the risk if you bought the shares, and even though you sold them on, you bought them and you were responsible for that bargain. And they, brokers were, some I think did it with pleasure, others did it rather shamefacedly, but their clients, the institutions, were flexing their muscles, becoming very important in the market. And that then became as restrictive practice as such that you wouldn't, should we say, do a put through for an eighth, the various, what the stock was and the price and so on. And that again got busted a bit. But I think it was a sort of warning that, you know, you could push the jobbers too far, although jobbers always tended to be rather disunited and competitive, whereas but I think decimalisation was a great saving factor.
Looking at joint books and minimum spread agreements, I would have thought that implied some degree of cooperation amongst jobbers.
For that period of time.
Yes. Were relations generally good between the firms right up to the end of single capacity?
On the whole, I should say yes, in firms. Individuals in firms against individuals in other firms could be quite tricky, but up at the top it was reasonably accepted that there had to be sort of some general agreement and some standards. I think that jobbers were always great individualists, and they regarded poaching on their market in the early days as great displeasure. I mean, I remember on one occasion, one jobber had taken up a stock, the jobber B. Dilton. And jobber B's head partner came over and his hands in his pockets and stared at jobber A's board and said, right, I'm going to deal in that and that and that, and walked off. So you did sort of three for one, but it balanced itself out. Mm-hmm. I think very much it was like the House of Commons. Mm-hmm. The battle was fairly on and fought on the House. Outside relations were very good. Mm-hmm. And at certain times, jobbers, again, I'm thinking more the at the top end of it, where people had made their names or reputations and so on, were helpful. If somebody had come unstuck, and whereas the lower racial might want to kick him in the teeth, a chap would say, well, it's no good if, you know, if this chap got wrecked on some particular bargain. We'd only have somebody else coming in to deal in that stock, so we might as well help the devil we know. I think this was more prevalent probably in the gilt market than in the equities, although I do know one or two cases where one of the smaller jobbers who got into deep water, dealing larger than he should, and one of the big jobbers sort of took a chunk of it off him. Actually, in the end, he didn't lose out on it, but, you know, felt for the worth of keeping the opposition, because there wasn't that desire really to drive anybody to the wall by the end of the time. So many had already gone, as I said. I know how many I'd started. I mean, there's probably about 130 odd jobbers.
Does that mean that as senior partners, or by that stage directors, you felt a duty to keep the jobbing system going?
Yes, very much. I'd certainly like to say this year of Esmond Erlacher, whom I didn't always agree with, but I think he took a very wide range of the responsibility of the jobbing system. And he was a leading factor, I think, in its survival and showing that it was a responsible community, you know, that we weren't just sort of brigands, because I think the early descriptions of jobbers in the coffee house days were fairly rude.
How are you getting on with the brokers towards the end of the jobbing system? What did they feel about, for example, minimum spread agreements?
If there was a genuine case for it, and as I say, mostly it was genuine, and it wasn't abused, they accepted it, because, as I say, it meant that there was still a market it going. And also, as I say, they could open inside. There was nothing, if the quote was important, they could say, well, you know, do you want to give me any more, or do you want to take a bit less? But it meant that they had to open if everybody was paying correctly. But it didn't mean, therefore, that they couldn't deal inside that quote. And as I say, the Office of Fair Trading couldn't believe that jobbers weren't taking the profit on the difference between the price they were prepared to buy and the price they were prepared to sell. They say we'd all been retired after 10 years, but that had been true. I think relations towards the end were really fairly good, because one could see the line-up coming, what was going to be happening. And also, let's be honest too, the jobbers also took an appreciation of the difficulties of brokers being pushed by very large clients. They didn't want to offend the prudential, I wouldn't say, because I think they dealt very, very correctly in all times I've come across them. But some of the other ones who were rather more competitive were leaning on the broker to do something against the job. So one realised that they had their problems, same as we had ours. So I think it became quite, towards the last 5 or 6 years of the old stock exchange, we began to appreciate one another's problems.
Mm. How did the brokers feel about single capacity? Did they feel the same sense of wanting to keep it going that the jobbers felt?
Well, this I would only be able to guess at because I had retired a good bit before that. I think there were some of the older people felt that there was a system that they had grown up with that they understood, that they could exploit to their benefit, the client's benefit and so on. Others felt that there was a brave new world there which they were going to jump into, and the money offered them to, at the start, it was so enormous that it would certainly outweighed any judgment, I would have thought. So that I think of the older ones particularly, they would have felt the loss of the personal touch, to the face-to-face dealing, the leg pull. They were, look, you know, I want help on this one, and because of the past, and no doubt because of the future as well, the job would say, okay, I'll do that for you, and even if it was wrong. Mm. And that was obviously going by the board. So a lot of the old days and the way of life had gone. Mm. And whether the money made up for it, I suppose if you hadn't been in the old days, it would certainly be attractive.
Did you feel, though, for example, towards the end of the 1970s, when you'd become now chairman of Biscuit Bishop, that there was any pressure on single capacity?
The pressure was beginning to build up more on overseas stocks, where the borderline was beginning to get a bit frayed. I think the BP new issue threw it up, the divergence between a jobber and a broker, and they both blame the other for trading just outside the guidelines. So it was obviously, it was beginning to become important, and of course the whole time the institutions were becoming more powerful. And as they became more powerful, they became more international. And you might, should we say, be able to control to a very mild degree the English, but you weren't going to be able to control the Americans or the Japanese, or I don't remember the Germans or French really coming into our market very much, but certainly the Americans and so on, and the Japanese later. There was going to have to be a new system, and the brokers, I think, very rightly said, well, if you were setting up in the market, you're going to be able to deal with these people, then it's not fair that we should be tied to dealing with you in other circumstances. Mm. Because the basis in the old days was, of course, that except under exceptional circumstances, the business had to go through the stock exchange, so therefore through the jobber. So they felt that they would be giving everything away. So I think once it got that big, it had to go. But it was an efficient system in its day, and as I say, it was always very adaptable to the needs. It wasn't hide bound and died because of its lack of desire to branch out, try new things.
You've already described in general terms what you did when, as a market official, when you were appointed a market official. I was wondering whether you could, without necessarily mentioning names of individuals or firms, describe the kinds of problems that would come up and that you would have to deal with.
Yes. I think they came really under two headings. Disputes and interpretation of the rules of the stock exchange. The disputes could come from anything, really. Mostly they would be a disagreement between a broker and a jobber. Might have been something to do with a firm limit and any situation arising from dealing. Now, by coming into the on the market officials early, it was then the dispute was limited to the broker and the jobber who directly involved. In the old days, it could have got out of hand before that. The head partner of the broker being called in, the head partner of the jobber being called in, then they were locked, and it would really become then a very serious problem. And obviously, both the brokers liked to back his dealer and the jobber his dealer. So it made a lot of bad blood. Now, if you could stop it early, and you just sat them down, and we told them straight away, we could only advise and guide, and began to cool off. And then they realized that, I suppose it's true to say that there's never, except a very, very few cases, was really somebody was 100% wrong and somebody 100% right. And if there was, you could guess that one or the other had been trying to get away with something. So then you could, you know, sort of push the boot a bit more. But otherwise, you said right now, listen to it, both sides. And because I think the first lot were Ransom was head partner of Smith and Paul Bessel Jett was a great friend of mine there, days of head partner of Phillips and Drew. When I went there, it was Nigel Morden and James Capel, senior dealer, and myself. So, you know, over the years, we'd been around and we'd seen most things, good and bad. And, you know, people were then prepared to accept this, that they weren't being told by some official up in the stock exchange who hadn't been on the floor of the house. We usually end up by saying, well, look, don't forget, this is one dispute, and you don't expect to be leaving next year, do you? No? No? So you might be 10 years? Well, you're going to know one another for 10 years. It's not really worth bringing this to a boil, and we think you should do this, but you don't have to. If you want to appeal to the up to the council, certainly, but this is what we think. If you're 9 times out of 10, they went off and had a drink. And I think this was very good, because it did stop it very early. The next thing was, which were really the rules, and that I suppose that some of us were poachers turned gamekeepers, so we knew the rules, and we knew possibly how they could be avoided in certain circumstances. So this we were able to interpret, and this was much easier, because the rule involved was this, and we had the rule book there, and if we wanted to refresh our memories about it, we could look it up. And this again stopped things early. In other words, instead of somebody doing something wrong, then having a dust up, then the sort of general flare up and possibly cancellation of a bargain or debiting somebody something, would come along and say, look, this is what I want to do, is it okay? And we say, yes, that's fine, or no, you mustn't, you've left it till 2 o'clock, and the fact the price has changed at 1 o'clock, you've got to go and to him first and say, look, this is a situation, and just complete my bargain, so on and so forth. The other thing which was, we did a fair amount too, the rules on put-throughs and marking. In the ordinary way, put-throughs had to be marked, but there were certain circumstances in which it need not be marked. And this was had always been a somewhat grey area, and I think we were useful in doing this. There were two sorts. I'll do the simple one first. Were a redemption of debentures early. If the basis of the market was ordinary, I think it was 92. And a company wanted to redeem a chunk, or had to redeem a chunk, and had found a seller at 95 and wanted to do it, and wanted to deal 95 and an eighth, put them and give that so the business could go through at 5 to 1/8, although the actual ordinary dealing price was 92. And if that was the end of the purchase for that year, then we could say that, okay, it needn't be marked. The other ones were usually more tricky in the equities. But if it was a large amount of stock off the market basis, that was meant the completion of the order, then again we could say yes, that's okay. If it wasn't the completion of the order, the seller was selling them below the market price and it would want to do more, then you might have to say no, this can't be done. It's got more to do, it must be marked, because it's altering the true price. The other to put through the debenture wasn't altering the true price, it was just a special deal. So we used to do a certain amount of that, and then there were odd personal things too. We came across odd disputes when we the rule as to sort of whether it was a 50-50 mistake, some mistake gone wrong, or 60-40, or I think 80-20, it was obvious that somebody was really wrong, so there were many of those, but 60-40 was about the average, and slightly more mistake on one side than the other.
I take it you would be available continuously while dealing was taking place?
Yes, we had a little box on the on the floor of the house. One of us would always be there. If it was a fairly tricky one, probably if it had to be done in a hurry, then one of you would do it. But normally we tried to do two, a broker or a jobber, or two jobs, it didn't matter. But in that stage we were doing it really as a stock exchange. We had taken off our jobbing hats or broking hats, as the case might be. So there was always somebody there. If not, there was a telephone where we could be got at. And my firm's pitch was, where the fireplace is, so I just poked my head around the corner, or I could be on the pitch and go into the thing within seconds, into the box.
When did the stock exchange start appointing market officials?
Must have been the late 70s, I should think. Mm. So I think Renson and Bazalgette were the first two.
Was this in response to problems that had been building up?
It was an intelligent idea, I think, from the council. They had a disciplinary commission, and some of the people on that mightn't have been market makers. In other words, they weren't on the floor of the house and and also it involved them in quite a lot of wasted time. And by the time it had got to the council, as I say, there was usually a head partner and a witness and a dealer and vice versa. And they thought, surely we can stop some of this before it comes. But if it's if the market officials is not accepted, they must have the right to appeal to the council. And I think I'm right in saying that we only had one, and there was Peter Stevens was the chairman of that committee, was a very good man on it, I think. And he backed us up. We were in the right, but this chap was really behaved really stupid, and I think he knew he was wrong, and that made him more bloody minded, and he thought he'd go to the council. But I think that was one out of umpteen that we had.
Now, finally, you told me that you were a member of the Stock Exchange Examination Board.
Yes, that was another of my...
What did that involve?
This is quite interesting. Again, it was very much the idea which the Stock Exchange had of using amateurs with some knowledge to do the work. There was a professional examiner, and then there was my chairman and usually four or five of us. I think it was in two parts. We met to decide on the questions. This was covered a pretty broad spectrum, so that the chap would really know something about the stock exchange, other than purely a broking, as what he would pick up as a broker or as a jobber. So that meant the rule books, which would cover stuff, as I say, like put-throughs, firm limits, common ex dividends. That was another question that came up, particularly from the tax point of view on the honorary market officials, was when they could deal common ex dividend and special. That I think came from the Inland Revenue wanted the stock exchange to investigate these switches between gross funds and those paying tax and so on. Then there was the etiquette, and then it could go to such things as counsel, name three of the committees and what they were responsible for. And then I tried to get Dada to have an odd question of an essay to show that chap A could write and B had thinking, in other words, not just mugging up something by heart. So we occasionally did that. The other guideline we had to follow was, of course, that jobbers and brokers were both sitting in the same exam. So it was useful that the broker should know something of the jobber, but he wouldn't expect it to answer it easily. I mean, that he would have had to have learnt, and similarly the other way around. So we had to offer something that was virtually an alternative to broker and jobber, and put a few more questions than they had to answer. So there was, you know, you could pick and choose a bit. These were then set, and then when the results were out, one occasion I remember, it was over Christmas, I think the examiner was, either the examiner was ill or there'd been a lot of people applying that particular time, and so then we had to mark the papers as well, which was very interesting actually. Normally the examiner did the marking, of course made it better because he knew what his answer, or the answer he was looking for, and so he was marking exactly the same, whereas if you had six people looking for something different, it made it a bit more tricky. Mm. Then we had to decide the pass marks, that is, below which people had obviously failed, either done no work or didn't care or were ignorant. And then there was the main body who had passed and obviously had done something and knew most of it. And then there were people with a distinction who had really knew the thing. Still didn't mean that they would be good dealers, but at least they knew about the stock exchange.
Mm. How long were you a member of the examination board?
About 3 years.
Mm. Was that towards the end of your...
Yes, it was. It was when I was no longer running a book.
Mm. Mm. Well, finally, when you were describing how you decided to... apply for a job in Biscuit Bishop, you'd said that you went out with a little book that you'd had describing the work of the stock exchange, and you originally thought that the stock exchange was about buying and selling what you didn't have.
Buying what you didn't want and selling what you hadn't got. This was in the book. Fortunately, when I was asked, when I went up for my interview, and I was thinking of quoting that, and I took one look at the granite face opposite me and decided I'd better hold my tongue.
But in retrospect, you never thought that was had any grain of truth.
Oh, it did. Very often I bought stock I didn't want, I couldn't get out of, or I sold something that I didn't have and didn't know when I was going to get it. I know there's quite a lot of truth in it, but it was obviously a chap coining a phrase to sell the book. But there's more in it than science.
Mm. I think we'll finish there.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Well.